This is Where We Live.
Obviously, our troops and the American people and the American taxpayers made huge investments and sacrifices in order to give Iraqis the opportunity to chart a better course, a better destiny. But ultimately, they're going to have to seize it. As I said before, we are not going to be able to do it for them.
That's President Barack Obama speaking Friday about the deteriorating situation in Iraq. I'm John Dankosky. Since he made those remarks, the American embassy in Baghdad announced it would be evacuating some personnel this week. Militants say they executed 1,700 Iraqi soldiers in Tikrit. U.S. drones are gathering intelligence for possible airstrikes. After thousands of lives and trillions of dollars spent, what has happened in Iraq? Today, Where We Live, we're joined by a panel of experts and veterans who served in Iraq. You can join us, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. We'll start with Jeremy Pressman, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. Welcome to our show. Thanks, Jeremy, for being here.
Thanks, John.
What's happening in Iraq right now seems as though it's exactly what we feared. Maybe you can explain how we got to the point where what we worried would happen seems to be happening. Militants have taken over this country.
Well, one thing I think we have to remember is we're not just talking about Iraq. We're also talking about Syria. And so part of what we're seeing is the spillover effect of the connections between Sunni militants in Syria and Sunni militants spreading into Iraq and connecting groups across international borders. We tend to think in terms of international borders. Transnational actors obviously don't always do that. The second thing I think that's very important to think about are the limitations of the Maliki government, the government of Iraq, and their difficulty or some would say, I think, and I would lean in this direction, their unwillingness to work better to incorporate the Sunnis, the Sunni Iraqis and the Sunni Iraqi political leaders into the system. So what we're also partly seeing is a government that was representing the majority of the country, the Shiite majority, and didn't do a great job in trying to tamp down some of the Sunni dissatisfaction in the decades since the fall of Saddam.
And in his speech on Friday, President Obama had some fairly strong words for the Maliki government, talking about the fact that that country needs to essentially stand up on its own. Of course, as with most things, we cannot forget the fact that the situation right now in part was abetted by Americans. I mean, the Sunni government that was in place at the time was wiped out. And so now we have a little bit of what we expect to have happened over the course of these last 10 years.
Saddam Hussein, when he was president of Iraq for decades, represented largely the Sunnis, who are a small proportion of the country. And I think that it was legitimate for the United States to hope that after the fall of Saddam that there might be a better system. The Shiites, who represent 60 or 65% of the country, we were hoping for something better. That said, it demonstrates, I think, once again, and we've seen this in everywhere from Vietnam to Afghanistan, the great difficulty. You do not control local leaders. You do not control local actors. And they have their own political interests, and they're going to advance those political interests often to the detriment of what the United States wants.
If you want to join our conversation about Iraq, 860-275-7266, I will let you know that coming up later on in the day on Point with Tom Ashbrook, they'll be continuing this conversation about, again, the deteriorating situation in that country. I want to welcome in two men who fought and served for the country in Iraq, Mike Zakea, who's a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel who works with veterans now at the University of Connecticut. He's joined us on the program before. Michael, good to see you once again.
Thanks, John.
And Ramon Baca is here. He's a former Marine Sergeant, and he's Artistic Director and General Manager of the Ballet Theater Company. He's joined us to talk about his work in Iraq as well. Ramon, thanks for being here.
Pleasure, John.
I'd like to get your thoughts, both of your thoughts, especially Mike Zakea, as we've talked with you so many times about your work in trying to train Iraqi forces in getting the people of Iraq to be able to defend themselves. When you hear the president talk about just that utter failure, it seems right now, on the part of Iraqi forces, what do you think?
The people that I served with and the other advisors that I served with are – the word I would use is distraught about the collapse of the Iraqi 4th Division in the face of vastly inferior forces. But nobody is surprised, and that's the main thing that I'm getting from the people that I served with and other advisors who were worked with the Iraqi army, is that they could foresee this happening. In 2006, I testified to a joint field session of the House and Senate Armed Forces Committee, and I said that it would take 10 years to create an army that was capable of standing on its own and conducting its own operations. And, you know, we're just about 10 years now from the date that we started the Iraqi army in 2004. And now we have the answer. And the answer is that it was a failure.
It was a failure at this point, which must be very difficult for you and others who worked in that world. Ramana, I'd like to get your take because, again, for the many men and women who served the United States in Iraq, you see what's happening now, and I think you must feel what we're all feeling, but just so much more acutely, that all that work, all of those lives, all that money, it seems right now to not be paying dividends.
It's not, and it's extremely disheartening to see all of the work and all of the momentum that has built up in the country. I had a meeting with one of the directors of the Ministry of Culture about a week ago, and his conversation was extremely inspiring, talking about the work that they were doing in cultural diplomacy and working towards initiatives that could bring together the different sectarian groups and point them towards their foundation as a country in a very rich history and in very rich culture. And this conversation that I had pointed in a direction that the Ministry of Culture was working very hard artistically to bring these groups together, and to see this fall a couple days later was extremely disheartening.
The idea that these groups, Sunnis and Shia, would not be able to work together, Mike Segea, how much evidence of this did you see on the ground? Did you expect that 10 years on that we would have had a bit of mending of these relations, that Sunni and Shia would be able to work together to have a functioning government and to have a functioning military and to run a country?
When we started the battalion and my team, we built and trained the first Iraqi Army battalion trained by the U.S. military. We had three distinct groups. We had Sunni, we had Shia, and we had Kurds. And it seemed as if they all carried with them a political agenda in enlisting in the first Iraqi Army battalion. It seemed like no group wanted to be left behind in the reconstruction. Certainly the Peshmerga I know or the Kurds, because they were all Peshmerga, and talking to them, they told us that they were assigned by their political parties to enlist in the Iraqi army. In our unit, we personally did not have any problems between Sunni and Shia, but the real problem was in getting the Iraqis to fight. We were successful ultimately. We made the assault in Fallujah. We were the only Iraqi army battalion that actually made the assault. But that was the challenge, was getting Iraqis to actually fight.
And again, that seems to be the problem once again in the face of this ISIS terrorist group. I'm wondering, Jeremy Pressman, two things. If you can give us a sense of what you know about this new group, and it's not new, but it seems new to our worldview, ISIS, which seems to be sweeping into Baghdad and perhaps threatens to take over the entire country. Why is it that we are unable seemingly to stop this advance? Why is it that the Iraqi forces that have been left there by Mike Segea and others have been unwilling to fight ISIS?
Well, I think a few things, John. I would caution at this point, I don't think we're at the point where ISIS is going to take over the whole country. ISIS is operating thus far in an area that is either a largely Sunni area or in close proximity to that. As they push into the northeast towards Kurdish areas or south into the deeply Shiite areas, I think it's going to be more challenging. They've been operating largely in an area with a sympathetic population that feels left out by the central government. ISIS is generally talked about as an offshoot of al-Qaeda. There was a split between al-Qaeda and ISIS. Al-Qaeda central, if you will, under Zawahiri, has a different organization in Syria that we've talked about at other times, al-Nusra. And so this is kind of a split within the jihadist camp. I think, again, in terms of talking about ISIS's success inside Iraq, we have to talk about some of the things that Mike brought up in terms of the disappointment with the performance of the Iraqi army. And I think we also have to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, the inability of the central government of Iraq to create a political vision and a political system in which you could start to bring in some of these groups. The last point I'd make is you have to think about sectarianism as maybe right now the dominant lens, but not the only way to understand how Iraqis relate to each other or how people in Syria relate to each other. We have a tendency to, I think, sometimes always gravitate towards the sectarian lens. And I think we should be careful about that because that sort of forecloses the possibility of any other more peaceful outcome.
I think it's fair to say, though, that heading into our engagement in Iraq, we didn't pay enough attention to the sectarian lens. And that's part of the problem that we've gotten into in this intervening decade.
I think that's fair, but I think what also tends to happen is if we only see Iraq as Sunnis, Shiites, and Sunnis, then we foreclose the possibility of an Iraq in which there's a more inclusive political vision.
I'm wondering, Roman, if you can touch on that, because as you've said, you've talked with people who desperately want to bring these various factions together. Do you see hope in any of this?
It's a very complicated situation. One of the interpreters I was working with had to work in three different languages, Kurdish, Arabic, and English. And she gave us insight into just the diverse amount of culture that is in Iraq. I mean, you're not only dealing with the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurdish. You also have the Assyrians and the Turkoman. And trying to get all of these groups to work together is a formidable, formidable journey.
We're talking about Iraq today with some people who are there and people who study what's happening in Iraq today. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I do want to bring in Abdallah, who is an Iraqi interpreter for U.S. forces. He worked alongside Mike Zakeya there. And Abdallah, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering first if you can tell me what you are hearing from your family in Iraq. What are they telling you about what's happening where they are?
It was a shock for everybody to have a second largest city in Iraq to just fall like that fast with all of that security forces there. Like there were two divisions, and that was because of the bad leadership and there's not enough discipline and. Unfortunately, that's something that was shock, but also was expected due to this dispute among the political leaders. They didn't come to agreement. They kept fighting each other for the who want to be the prime minister, who want to be take that political position. And that adversely affect the people, the troops on the ground.
One thing I'm interested in, though, and Jeremy Pressman was just touching on this, despite these disputes between political leaders of various sects or disputes between extreme militant groups on one side or the other, is there a deep animosity between people on the ground in Iraq of various sects? I mean, when you get outside the political, Abdallah. Are you worried that some of these tensions actually spill over into the general population as well?
That's exactly. This is the problem, the main problem there. The regular people they don't care about their what's the Sunni or Shia like, but now the political leader they deepen this the sectarian. Values and they want to gain more people from this sect or another sect to support their position to get power out of them. But that's what's happening now. That's the main reason why we're going through all that.
But Mike Zakeya, I'm wondering if you can pick up on this as you hear your friend talk and the disappointment in both your voices. This is, as with many things in the world, it seems a political problem more than a problem amongst people, Mike.
Yes. And something that Jeremy mentioned also, it's a political problem. It's also a leadership problem. The Iraqi leadership, they were good leaders and we had to find good leaders. But the tendency is to promote people not based on their merit, but based on relationship or political advantage. The other part of it is that the leadership is spectacularly corrupt, unbelievably corrupt. I had a moment of clarity when I was in Iraq. I was watching a CD of The Sopranos, and it was an episode where they're scheming how to fleece the New Jersey Sports Authority. And I had this moment where I said, this is how the whole thing works in the Iraqi army. It's all about how do I extract as much resources out of the public or out of my position as possible. And that's the way it was in the Iraqi government as well. When I was there, or shortly after I left, the former Minister of Defense, Hazam Shalan, absconded from the country with $1 billion. He just took as much as he could and he left. So the corruption is an unbelievably important part of this as well.
Mike Sakai is a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel who served in Fallujah in Iraq. Ramon Baca is a former Marine Sergeant, and he's also Artistic Director and General Manager of the Ballet Theater Company. He has worked on bridging cultural divides in that country. Jeremy Pressman also joins us. He's an Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. I want to thank Abdallah, who is an Iraqi interpreter for U.S. forces, who worked alongside Mike Sakai for lending some of his expertise today. Abdallah, best wishes to you. Thank you so much for your time today. When we come back, we'll take some more of your questions as well as we continue our conversation about what's happening in Iraq today, where we live. This is Where We Live.
We're seeing a country that is ripping apart along ethnic and religious lines. ISIS taking Sunni areas, mixed areas, the semi-autonomous region in Kurdistan, hardening their lines and taking territory they believe is theirs, and then the Shias in Baghdad in the south.
That's NPR Middle East correspondent Leila Fadel speaking on Morning Edition today about the situation in Iraq. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about what's happening there with Jeremy Pressman from the University of Connecticut, Mike Sakai, who's a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel who now works with veterans here at the University of Connecticut. Ramon Baca is a former Marine Sergeant. He's Artistic Director and General Manager of the Ballet Theater Company. I want to bring into the conversation Joshua Ellis. He's a sergeant with 101st Airborne Division at the start of the invasion. His last 6 months in Iraq were spent in the region currently under siege by ISIS. Joshua, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What can you tell us about this region that's currently in the news? You served in the areas of Mosul and Tal Afar that was just captured this morning. What can you tell us about this region?
Yeah, it was quite eye-opening. Honestly, when I had heard that ISIS had taken those two areas, you know, Tal Afar is a really diverse populace there. You know, in that northern part of the country, you have right there near Turkey, you have the Kurdistan, you know, the Kurds up north, and then you have pretty diverse Shiite and Sunni population. So, you know, my first reaction was kind of what was coming out in the news today about the massacres. You know, that was what I was kind of anticipating would happen, unfortunately.
And again, these are reports of large-scale massacres being reported by ISIS of some 1,700 Iraqi troops. Those, as of right now, at my last reading, had yet to be confirmed. You were in the country at the start of the invasion, Joshua. I'm wondering how what you're seeing now compares with some of the feelings and thoughts you had going into this war in Iraq.
We could be here all day explaining that one. But you know, when we took the north and locked it down, as so to say, you know, when we left, it was a you know, it was running. Reconstruction was booming. You know, and it looked like, you know, we didn't have as many attacks as they had down there in Fallujah and Baghdad. It wasn't as much of a hot spot as it is today. And that's when we left in 04. And unfortunately, you know, we took that for granted, which I think we took for granted pulling out of the country in 2011. I think we should have left a residual force to continue to support and prevent attacks like what's taking place right now. But you know, we also made that mistake back in 04 when the 101st pulled out. You know, we just replaced it with a striker brigade, and that led to you know, that region becoming a hot spot. And over the years, it's kind of degraded to where we're at today.
Well, one of the things I want to ask our panelists is just that. One of the big questions is how much of what we're seeing today, Jeremy Pressman, can we trace to the United States designed to pull out in 2011, to leave no forces really in Iraq? I mean, how much can we say is because the United States is not there at this moment?
I think it's a relevant factor, but I think we also have to look back at the discussion that took place in late 2011. Iraq was unwilling to provide the United States the kind of legal protections for its forces that the United States regularly expects in a continuing presence situation. And we can talk about it as being a hypothetical possibility, but it wasn't much of an option on the table. The Iraqi parliament was very, very unlikely to approve an agreement that gave those kind of legal protections for U.S. forces. And so I think it's more of a hypothetical possibility than a real one.
I'd love your thoughts on this, Roman.
I think Jeremy has a great point in that when we were there, the rules of engagement tied us down so much in how we could operate and what we could do without those permissions and without that legal protection provided by the Iraqi parliament. Being there would have just been a formality.
I would have liked, and as I mentioned, I testified in 2006, I would have liked to see us reinforce success where we had it, which was in the north in what is the semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan. I would have liked to see us cut a deal with the Kurds and keep a strategic reaction force on the ground in Kurdistan to respond to contingencies like this.
The White House says it has a brief window to pursue diplomacy. Jeremy Pressman, what do we think about diplomacy at this point? It doesn't seem promising right now, but what do you think about this tack?
Well, I think the negative side of it is that we've pressed the Iraqi government for years. We pressed the Iraqi government when we had many U.S. forces in Iraq, many more than we have today, and in many cases we were unsuccessful. So I think there's reasons to be pessimistic. In contrast, both Iran and the United States, normally adversaries, are very concerned about the current situation. The two countries don't have a great working relationship, but the possibility that both the United States and Iran, and especially given Iran's interests in Syria, might work together, maybe we shouldn't totally discount the possibility of diplomacy.
But would there be worries that Iran's interest is also along sectarian lines?
Iran's interests are along sectarian lines, absolutely. But sometimes we make difficult alliance choices, and sometimes interests overlap in ways that can be helpful.
Mike, do you have thoughts on that?
Yes. We understand, or my understanding anyway, is that Maliki is basically on retainer from Iran, that he's basically doing the bidding of Tehran. And I recall that when he was in exile, he lived in Iran while he was in exile. So I really consider him an extension of the Iranian government. And, I think this makes for strange bedfellows. But at the same time, I think that the Sunni population in Iraq has legitimate beef, that they've been significantly disenfranchised from what we claimed or what we thought was we were bringing democracy to this country.
Joshua Ellis, before I let you go, this idea of the Sunni population having a legitimate beef, I'm wondering how that sits with you and whether or not you have any hope at this moment, given what you're seeing on the ground right now.
I always have hope. I always look at our country and what our goals were going in. It always comes back to it doesn't come down to X's and O's. It's a cultural difference, and you have extremists on both sides. And sometimes the speaking reason or diplomacy, it just doesn't work. We pray that it does. We don't want to see, where we've lost men and women. We don't want to see that go back to an area that's opposite of what our goals were and what our intentions were, was to bring diplomacy to the country. And we hope, and we pray that this will turn around and that the extremists will, back out and, be quieted. But, I don't know where my hope is for it, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Joshua Ellis has spent the last 6 months in the region currently under siege by ISIS. He was a sergeant in the 101st Airborne Division at the start of the invasion as well. Joshua, thank you so much for your time. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
These cultural differences that he speaks about, Roman, I think that this is part of it. We overlay our Western ideas into this region all the time, and this seems once again to be coming home to roost. We're talking about talking at a time when people are acting in ways that are savage and brutal, and we can't really fathom, but indeed that's what's happening as we talk about talking.
I do think we try to overlay our ideals on a country that we don't really understand, but giving a nod to Jeremy and his input, and then talking about hope. I think one of the things that I discovered in 2012 when I went back and worked with two different populations, I worked with Kurdish and I worked with the Arabic from Kirkuk and brought them together, one of the great things that came out of that was these young people staged a protest in Kirkuk speaking up against the violence and coming together in a resounding voice saying that they wanted to live in a safe place. And I think the answer to your question is the hope lies hopefully in the young people because they are the ones that are working to bridge the sectarian divides. And hopefully as this goes on, the young people can come together and make their voice a big one and make the government react.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Did you want to jump in, Jeremy?
The Iraqi people have suffered greatly. Both, you know, we debate a lot about the 2003 invasion, but I think one uncontested point is that both before 2003 and after 2003, the Iraqi people have suffered. And we all hope they can find a better way. If it's through the youth, that would be great. We're crossing our fingers.
It's obviously a conversation that will continue. It's good to see some folks who we've spoken about this in the past and hopefully speak again under better circumstances with Mike Zakea, retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel who works with veterans now at the University of Connecticut. Thanks, Mike. It's great to see you.
Thanks, John.
Also, thanks to Roman Bach. He's a former Marine Sergeant. He's also Artistic Director and General Manager of the Ballet Theater Company. Thank you, Roman.
Thanks for having me here.
And thank you to Jeremy Pressman. He's Associate Professor of Political Science, Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. Thank you, sir. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll be live talking to artists, musicians, and thinkers at New Haven's Arts and Ideas Festival. You can join us live at the study on Chapel Street. It's part of a day-long broadcast at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. It will include the Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock. You can join us for Arts, Ideas, and much more on Where We Live tomorrow. Hope to see you there. The year is 1914. Trapped in Antarctica with no hope of rescue, the great British explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton kept 27 men alive for 2 years in the most inhospitable climate on Earth. 95 years later, in the worst economic meltdown since the Great Depression, Hartford insurance man Walter Spivey relives Shackleton's story, struggling to justify his recent promotion and save his employees' jobs. Yeah, that's a connection you might not naturally make. A great explorer and an insecure insurance salesman, but it's the basis for Split Knuckle Theater Company's play Endurance at Long Wharf Theater starting tomorrow. WNPR's Katie Tolarski and Jonathan McNichol talk to playwright Nick Ryan and artistic director Greg Webster. Webster's a New Haven resident and a University of Connecticut professor in movement theater. Here, Webster talks a bit about the main character.
Walter Spivey is this Hartford insurance agent whose office is collapsing around him as a result of the economic crisis. You know, a Hartford insurance man doesn't consider himself just to be a Hartford insurance man. Like all of us dream, right, of the things we want to become or what we do. And we all have grandiose plans in our psyche of our life and what we want to accomplish and those type of things. So that's the heroic versus the mundane. I mean, that all of us have a spark of that.
I've been promoted! What? Upper management, they promoted me. I'm managing this division of BMI. I'm a manager.
You got promoted?
They said my work was impeccable, my attendance record exemplary, that I'm a pillar of personal hygiene. I got the highest of ranks on those customer evaluation forms. You know, one of the little boxes. Yeah! I've been promoted!
Hey!
So Shackleton is this icon, bigger-than-life kind of guy, and Walter is not. So he's basically discovering, by virtue of this book that he finds in the Hartford Public Library, reading all the stuff that he did, and he tries to apply those lessons to his office, you know, as he's working with the stuff that's going around here, you know.
Larry, I think morale is at an all-time low, so I want you to go down to Dairy Queen and pick us all up some blizzards for the whole team.
All right. What about the toilet paper?
Well, while you're at it, pick us up some extra napkins.
One of the things that we were really interested in was kind of examining the 20th century man versus the 21st century man. So we said, okay, well, what can we learn from how Shackleton behaved? And just because as Americans, sometimes we don't really rally as a country until we're faced with incredible crisis. And we need to be hit over the head as a culture, as opposed to kind of seeing the warning signs of things. So Shackleton put this ad in the newspaper, and the ad read, "Men wanted
for hazardous journey. Small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success."
And 5,000 guys applied for that job. And Nick and I started talking, and I was like, well, you know, who would apply for that now? Like, we get upset when our latte doesn't have enough foam on it, and we start having a fit. And so it was kind of an examination of how tough those guys were then. Shackleton made a big point of interviewing all the guys that were on the ship, intensive interviews. And one of the big things he searched for was, do they have a sense of humor? Can they play musical instruments and sing? Because he knew that so much of the time was about waiting. And in the interview process, trying to figure out, was this someone that I can work with and harness their talents? And what's exceptional about these people? And so Walter is searching for that in the fact that he gets promoted in the face of his company being downsized. So he's trying to learn his way, and he effectively or ineffectively tries to implement these lessons that Shackleton is doing about leadership and how to respond. So that's where the comedy part comes in, is him attempting to do that and his failures or what he imagines will happen, what ends up happening. So we start to see the humanity in small moments of people just trying to deal with each other under really difficult circumstances, which we all had to endure and are continuing to endure as a country. And all of us have friends and family who lost jobs, who lost their houses, who did all that. So I think that's where the stories kind of meet each other to come together.
Come rude, boreas, blustering rammer. Come listen, ye landmen, all to me. Shipmate, dear, a brother sailor. Sing of the dangers of the sea.
What we really believe as a company is that the theater has to do something different than film and television. I don't want to pay $55 a ticket to go see a bunch of people sitting around chairs talking about their psychological problems. I can go to the movies for that, and I think the movies does it better. So what we try to do in our work is try and find a way to move the theatrical space and to provoke the audience's imagination to say, hey, come along with us on this journey. So a big part of our training is transforming simple objects into what can become multiple things. So one minute you're standing on top of a table, and the table, well, can the table turn over? Yeah, it can do that. Can the table spin on its end? Oh, that's interesting. Maybe that could be an iceberg. Oh, right. And if you flip it this way, then you can stand on it, and it's a deck of a ship. If we hook the tables together this way, it looks like an office pod. So it's lots of that kind of creative fishing and fooling around that eventually gets you there. So the audience follows this arc that actually is quite solid. And at this point, even though it sounds like total chaos in the creation process, which it is, it eventually becomes a highly polished machine.
What's our bearing, Mr. Worsley?
South by southwest, 20 knots from Gripbeacon's whaling station, boss. And there's South George Island on the horizon. The wind's to the aft of the Endurance.
How does she handle, skipper?
Oh, she's a fine little ship, boss. Carrying a bit of weight on account of the reinforcements to the hull, but I should have no trouble piloting her.
Hey, boss, I've wondered. You rechristened the ship the Endurance?
Fortitudine vincimus.
My Latin's a bit rusty.
My family motto, by endurance we conquer.
When we first started working on the play, all the members of the company did a tremendous amount of research. And then we had some ideas, and we had some journals from the members of the crew of the Endurance and the Shackleton story. And Nick was there at the same time, and then we would get up and we'd improvise something. We'd say, okay, well, let's look at something that's happening on top of the ship. And Nick would go, okay, all right, try something else. And we'd do something different, and he'd go, okay, I got an idea. Nick would go off, and he said, I think I can write what you guys just did.
My name is Nick Ryan. I was the playwright in the process of creating Endurance. I'd come with four pages or so that the company would take. They'd put those four pages up on its feet again. We'd do another revision process on its feet. I'd take that. I'd go and revise it. And we slowly kind of constructed the story that way. And from there, it was just straight to the library and just got as many books on Shackleton as I possibly could. And there's a tremendous wealth of diaries that the crew kept. We ended up using quite a few of those firsthand accounts to inform the writing process of the script. And the more I delved into this material, it's really, really stunning, just the wealth of information in there. I mean, I think that was kind of something we came back to a lot during the process of, we've got 10 plays here, basically. Mm-hmm. So the challenge became, how do we distill this down into a dramatic structure, essentially? I believe Frank Worsley, who was the navigator on the Endurance, his diary was very well written, and he would include passages of dialogue that he remembered. So I would write down like about a 5-line scene from that, 10-line scene. I'd bring that to the company and say, can we do anything with this? And more often than not, we'd be able to incorporate that into the Shackleton storyline.
Well, gentlemen, our turns arrive before us promptly. We shall meet them with equal haste. This shall be her first test. All ahead of the engines. All hands to station.
All hands to station.
One boy. Bring her out of the galleys.
Ken Clark, who's a wonderful musician and composer who did the music for the show, which is all composed stuff, he would be in the room and we'd be doing something and he'd say, well, okay, well, we're looking at, you know, something that's frantic right now. We need something that underscores this. And he'd start doing something and we'd respond to that. And so it's a lot like in jazz where there's a theme where someone lays something down and then the other players in there have to make something that kind of fits.
It's funny because there were, in the sources that we were looking through, there were a number, like right around like the late 90s, early 2000s, there were a number of books that were written just like how to lead like Shackleton in a business environment, basically. And they would distill certain lessons, like, for example, like when they were stranded on the pack ice and they had to set up tents, Shackleton would hit a technique where he would very specifically place people in tents very strategically because he knew that, well, this guy's a troublemaker. He's going to stay right here with me, basically. There was a whole chapter on this in one of the leadership manuals along the lines of, like, break up your team just so, you know, keep the troublemakers close, you know, all these sorts of things. And just reading them, it becomes very comical because it's literally taking ideas that were distilled by Shackleton in extreme survival mode and now being applied to cubicle arrangement, basically. The juxtaposition was oftentimes just hilarious, like unintentionally hilarious in these books.
All right, this is the problem. We are men. We're not meant to be in cubicles drinking lunch through a straw.
What?
This room.
This lunch hour. This place. We are predators!
Actually, we're omnivores.
Since studying him, he's become a personal hero. And I think it's like what a great CEO does in the fact that you have to look at the talents that your team or the people have that were within there. You have to celebrate them for what they're good at and who they are. And how can you allow that to breathe in your workspace, your creative space, and what have you? So a big part of my job is to get the right configuration of people in the room to accomplish the job and also to provide a space where people feel like they can use those talents. So I think that's been quite a humbling journey for me in trying to provide that. And like a great CEO to say to yourself, this is not about me, this is about us. And I think that's the death of a lot of companies and a lot of great theater companies when people start thinking that I made this. And it's the falling on the I that is less interesting to me than the we. And because our work is created off of the ideas of other people, that you're willing to have an idea and put it out there and also be willing to let your ego go when it doesn't work.
Chapter 2, dealing with the office in times of crisis. Knowing the members of your crew, who they are, their history, their interests, and talents is often beneficial in handling a crisis. Assembling a team is often the cornerstone of any well-functioning office. In assembling a crew, Shackleton knew the importance of face-to-face interviews and insisted upon them for every prospective crew member.
he's essentially considered a failure for what he did at the time, right? And World War I broke out when he came back, so no one was interested in this guy who didn't circumnavigate the South Pole and lost his ship and all that. That's not a story of heroes. But he was talking to these rich kids who are about to go off to Oxford and Eton and all these great schools. And he was talking at their graduation, and he said, "When faced with trouble, danger, or disappointment, never give up hope. Always remember that optimism is true moral courage." And that was intriguing to me because I'm this Irish Catholic, you know, things are terrible. And I think if I was on that journey, I probably would have been dead within the first 2 days, you know, and I'm a pretty tough guy. But that the fact that we are capable as human beings of doing incredible things and being really good to each other in the face of adversity, and we can choose to collapse, we can choose to let it all bog down because life is hard, or we can make another choice and say that, you know, being here in this moment is really important, and we will persevere, hence endurance.
That's Greg Webster, artistic director of Split Knuckle Theater Company, and playwright Nick Ryan. Endurance will be at Long Wharf Theater June 17th to the 29th. For more information, visit longwharf.org. This segment was produced by WNPR's Jonathan McNichol and our resident Shackleton nerd and executive producer, Katie Talarski. Where We Live is produced with Katie and Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.